Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Maria Carter. Our guest for this half hour is Jonathan Sperber. He's a history professor at the University of Missouri, Columbia, and recently authored the book Karl Marx, A 19th Century Life. He'll be at the downtown Kansas City Public Library tonight at 6:30. We're talking for the rest of the hour about Karl Marx. Professor Sperber, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, your subtitle is A 19th Century Life. Why is that time period important to understanding Karl Marx?
I think the book involves a different way to look at Marx. For a long time, people saw him as a contemporary, although he lived, you know, died 130 years ago. He was someone who seemed to have a unique insight into today's world. If you liked him, he was somebody who was a brilliant critic of capitalism. If you didn't, he was somebody who was an evil genius of totalitarianism. But that whole thing has come to an end since 1989. And I think it's more helpful to see Marx as a figure of a past historical era, the 19th century, and even in some ways a backward-looking figure, not someone who is prophesizing the future, but seeing the future in the past.
And your book really starts kind of before Marx was born a little bit, with his father's family and, kind of where he was born. And how did that factor into things?
Well, it factored into things in a number of different ways. One was that his... Marx came from a Jewish family. His father, though, broke with the tradition, was an attorney, an adherent of the Enlightenment, later became a Protestant. Marx was brought up as Protestant, a very different sort of way of things than family's history. He was also from the city of Trier, a little city in the far southwest of Germany, a city that in 1815 was incorporated into the Kingdom of Prussia. The inhabitants of Trier deeply, deeply hated the Prussians. And Marx developed that predilection, too, and it stayed with him for the rest of his life.
Sometimes those early things really kind of stick with you.
They do.
One of the, I think probably this has been written more volumes than anyone can count about is Hegel and Marx, the philosopher Hegel, and, you know, how he influenced Marx, especially early. How did that play into how Marx looked at the world?
Well, do you want the answer in like three sentences or less?
You can use four.
Right. Okay. Hegel's a very difficult, complex thinker. Marx was first exposed to him when he was a student at the University of Berlin, starting in 1837. And it's literally true that the experience of reading Hegel fell on him like a bomb. He was dazed. He was ecstatic. This is a very common thing for young German intellectuals at the time. It was almost a cult following. And it deeply and profoundly influenced the way he would look at the world. There are so many aspects of Hegel. I'll just mention, I think, two, which are important. One is Hegel's idea that philosophy was the queen of the sciences, that it was philosophy that determined what knowledge was, what the legitimate questions were for scholarly disciplines to ask, how one learned what the truth was. And that was an idea that Marx took up, although he would ultimately switch from philosophy to political economy or economics as the determinant of knowledge. The other thing about Hegel was his idea of this progression in human history. Human history was a progression, a dialectical progression, or dialectical or dialogical progression, which would ultimately result in Hegel's case in this sort of philosophical perfection, which he called absolute knowledge. Marx took this over and developed an idea of human history as a progression through different stages of modes of production, social struggles, which would eventually end up in the perfect state of communism.
Well, and one thing, it seems, kind of the importance of the truth of philosophy, that seems to, Marx kind of made enemies out of people if they didn't believe, if he thought their philosophy wasn't quite right, it seemed that is kind of, he would write them off and call them all sorts of names.
This may or may not be related to Hegel. Marx was a very intransigent, sort of irascible individual, and he did really want his followers to accept his ideas, and he had a lot of trouble working with people who had different points of view. There's no question about that.
One of the things that intrigued me about your book was just how widely read Marx was. In school in Germany. He was, you know, read all the classics, it sounds like, of, you know, Greek and Latin. And but then, you know, he was a fan of Shakespeare and Cervantes and various people. And really, then he also really deeply read, it sounded like, Adam Smith and David Ricardo and those classical economists.
Right. He did all those things. And I might add, he read and took extensive notes on agricultural chemistry. At one point, decided he needed to teach himself calculus. One of his friends once called him the Aristotle of the 19th century. And it's really true. He was a person of extraordinarily wide-ranging intellectual interests.
Yeah. I mean, so how did those kind of fall into Marx's worldview then? I mean, did they all play in?
In one way or another, I think they did. This in part relates to the way Marx worked at stuff. He was a guy who read a lot and took unbelievably extensive notes. Often one has the impression he took notes that were way too extensive. He was somebody who was he had difficulty getting things done, difficulty writing large pieces. And it was in part his tendency to want to read still more, to read yet another book on the topic, get another thing. He was just that sort of person. He liked to gather enormous amounts of information. Writing was for him a very painful process. It was difficult to get it out.
Yeah. I mean, his work habits seem kind of odd at times. You know, it sounds like his collaborator on a lot of things, Frederick Engels, was always pestering him to get things done.
Yeah. Engels, who was, you know, a businessman, he was a commercial clerk. He had this extremely neat handwriting. He was very punctual. He was a sort of steady, solid worker. He always got things done. It was such a contrast with his friend Marx, who had very bohemian habits and would stay up until 2 or 3 in the morning and sleep until noon, who worked in these spurts. He could just, like, write all day for several days in a row and then just stop for weeks at a time, and whose handwriting is notoriously difficult and largely indecipherable. They were just such different people, and yet they were such good friends. That's why.
well, their names go together all the time.
Yes.
What was their relationship and collaboration over the years?
Engels was in many ways Marx's first disciple. Marx, when he met Engels in 1844, he'd been this sort of protege of a number of older men who'd taught him things, get him jobs, sort of let him around. And he was getting increasingly frustrated with this. Engels was the first person who was willing to look up to Marx as sort of his leader intellectually, in part because of the very difficult family situation in which Engels found himself. And his adherence to Marx was a way out of this. And over a long, complicated process, they weren't exactly always on the same wavelength. And there were a number, in the early years of their acquaintance, there were a number of very nasty fights. People might have said that there were other people who were Marx's chief disciple. But once they were both living in exile in London, starting in 1849 and 1850, they became really inseparable. They became Marx and Engels' trademark, so to speak. That's when people started referring to them as a duo. And they remained for the rest of Marx's life, the next 33 years, sort of an inseparable political alliance.
Well, how much did Engels' financial support of the Marx family play into that?
This was an enormously important matter. They were both penniless refugees in London in 1850. They had big plans, interestingly enough, to come to the United States. They were going to move to New York City. They could not get the money together to do this. And they were both looking at a very difficult situation, and so they made a decision. Engels would move to Manchester. He would work for business associates of his father, who was a German manufacturer. And he would send money to Marx in London, who would be the guy who would write the political articles, write the economic and philosophical theory, who would be the chief political activist. So they developed this division of labor, which held up for the next 20 years. And it made it possible for both of them, I think, to function.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Maria Carter. Our guest is Jonathan Sperber. We're discussing his new book, Karl Marx, A 19th Century Life. Kansas City, what are your questions about the life of Karl Marx? Call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You know, Karl Marx really comes off as quite a family man in the book, too, you know, with his wife, Jenny, he seems very devoted to her and also, you know, his daughters.
He was. He was very much a loving husband and father. He deeply loved his wife. He was known among contemporaries as somebody who loved the company of children. He loved to play with children and hang out with them, and sort of a child-hearted guy. And they had seven children. One was stillborn, two died in infancy, and the last, the death of Marx's son Edgar at the age of eight, probably of a ruptured appendix, was a horrible tragedy. It was the greatest tragedy of his life and left him depressed for years. The three remaining daughters, to whom Marx was very devoted, who all grew up. He was a loving father, an intellectual disciple. And by the standards of patriarchal Victorian society, he was, I don't want to say an advocate of their emancipation, but he had a pretty good, he strove in many ways to offer them more than one might expect from young ladies. They went to secondary school, which was very unusual, especially in England at the time. He encouraged them to be politically active. They were all supposed to get married and be loving, supportive wives, which two of them did anyway. But he also expected them to be sort of their own people and think for themselves.
Well, one of the things that fascinated me was he seemed to need to maintain a bourgeois lifestyle as well. Why was that?
Well, at least the way Marx would put it was for his wife and children. He just felt he was horribly guilty. He felt horribly guilty about the fact that he had trouble earning enough money to support them in the standard of living to which they'd become accustomed. His wife was the daughter of a Prussian government official and expected a distinct standard of living. And Marx, although at times Thomas had a fairly lucrative job as a newspaper correspondent, he had great difficulty in supporting his family. And London was a very expensive city where they lived. And he just felt unbelievably guilty about not being able to do this.
I mean, he's the you know, champion of the proletariat, yet he had a maid.
He did have a maid. What I'd say to that is I think in the 20th century, we think that people's private lifestyle should correspond to their public political positions. I'm not sure people thought that in the 19th century.
Yeah, and he kind of had a little more relationship, it sounds like, with the maid.
Yeah, well, there's a notorious incident. She had a son. He got her pregnant. She had a son, Freddie Demuth, who was actually died of all Marx's children. He was the last to die in 1929. The matter was hushed up in Marx's lifetime. It was a big secret in the labor movement. It really only became public knowledge in the 1960s.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this was hushed up at the time. Did Engels was the one.
Yeah,
who said,
Engels right? Very, really, as a Engels, who was a lifelong bachelor and a sort of ladies' man, very gentlemanly fashion, agreed to claim that he was the father. Now, the trouble was when you looked at the little boy, Freddie Demuth, he didn't have a fair complexion like Engels, but a dark, swarthy one like Marx. So there was people sort of wondered about that. And Engels did it to save Marx's marriage. His wife was who was deeply suspicious of what had happened to the maid, who refused to say who the father was. And it would have been, I think, it would have been a disaster for them, which is why Engels was very nice to do that. On his deathbed, Engels, when he was dying of throat cancer and could no longer speak, he actually wrote out a confession stating the truth of this affair and what had happened over 50 years before.
Wow. One topic that you touch on several times in the book is, you know, Karl Marx, as he seems very ambivalent about Jews and Judaism. And why is that?
Well, that's true. Marx was, of course, of a Jewish background. He was brought up as a Protestant. The young Hegelians with whom he studied at the University of Berlin were all Protestant theologians. Marx became an atheist, of course, but like a lot of the young Hegelians, it was via Protestantism. And that was his background and the world. He tended to look at Jews through the eyes of liberal Protestant theologians who saw Judaism as an ethically inferior religion and Jews who practiced it as rather a shady lot. In doing this, he was asserting that to be Jewish was a matter of cultural and religious preference. You could change it, like Marx himself had done. He made a lot of nasty remarks about Jews. They were also some of his closest associates. Marx never denied his Jewish ancestry. And in some wonderful letters to his husband, his uncle, a Dutchman named Leon Phillips, he made a number of very ironic remarks about their common Jewish descent. What happened toward the very end of Marx's life, the last decade of his life, and after his death, was a new concept developed in Europe of what it meant to be Jewish, based on Charles Darwin's biological ideas, in which being Jewish was seen not as a matter of cultural and religious affiliation, but as a matter of biological descent, as being racial in terms. And it was sort of in retrospect that Marx became Jewish. He largely didn't see himself as being that way, and most of his contemporaries didn't really see him that way either. It was only in the end of his life and after his death that in retrospect he became a Jewish figure.
And does that lead to some of the misunderstandings of Karl Marx, how things changed after his death?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. Marx died. He left a small amount of published writing and a large body of unpublished writing, which his friend and associate Engels, who was also his literary executor, then proceeded to put together and publish and explain and give Engels' own distinct spin on it, which was probably a little different from Marx's ideas. I said at the end of the book, a lot of what we call Marxism might better be called Engelsism, because it was Engels' own interpretation of Marx's ideas. Some people accuse Engels of falsifying Marx, and I don't think that's true. They were friends and collaborators, and they thought alike about a lot of things. But in many areas in which Marx was a bit ambivalent or sort of could go one way or the other, Engels was very much sort of in one particular direction. And his interpretation of Marx tended to iron out a lot of the ambivalences and differences of opinion in Marx's thought.
Well, we have a caller, Paul from Overland Park. Good morning. And what's your question?
Well, I have a question and a comment. The question is, I don't know where, once the member reading or hearing someone say that Marx at one point claimed that he wasn't a Marxist, and I wondered if he'd ever heard of that. And the comment is, I'm sure he's been to Marx's birth house in Trier, and his feeling, his sense about that. I was there many years ago, and I was close to weeping for historical things that occurred and didn't occur and so forth. I just wonder what his sense of that place was. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, I'll be happy to answer those questions. The first group that called themselves Marxists were a group of socialists in France. At the end of the 1870s, the early 1880s, towards the very end of Marx's life, Marx's opinion of the French socialists was not very high. He thought they were a bunch of vain, egocentric, self-important people who constantly quarreled over ridiculous, trivial ideas. He didn't like his supporters any more than he didn't like his opponents. And he did once say, I won't do it in French, but it goes in English something like, all I can really say about this is that I am not a Marxist. And he was just basically saying that all these French socialists, even the ones who were his purported supporters, were a bunch of trivial guys. And towards the very end of his life, when he was dying of tuberculosis, he went to Paris to try and convince all these French socialists to give up their quarrels and get together. And that's where that comment, I am not a Marxist, comes from. And yes, of course, I've been to Trier, which is a beautiful German city, one of the few cities in the western part of Germany not touched by the Second World War and still in its original condition. Wonderful Roman ruins, a beautiful medieval cathedral, in a delightful setting on the Mosel River, just a beautiful city. And, of course, I've seen Marx's birth house, which is a museum now. But there's nothing much original in it. And there's just a bunch of photocopies of documents and pictures on the wall. So it's maybe not as impressive as some monuments and museums can be.
Well, this is a big book. I left it on my desk, but it's 550-some pages in there. How did you go about researching Karl Marx's life? There's been so much written and so much out there.
All right. There are two things I'll say. One is that I've been a historian of the 19th century for, 40 years now. I've written a lot of books about the Revolution of 1848, some of which Marx played a role. So I'm sort of familiar with the background and the perspective. That helps a lot. The other thing is that there's a new source available, which is enormously important. An edition of the total writings of Marx and Engels, which we know by its German acronym, MEGA. This contains literally everything they wrote, including the notes they scribbled on the backs of envelopes. It contains the letters written to them as well as the letters they wrote. It's an enormous project. It's been ongoing since 1975. It survived the end of communism. It's now sponsored by the government of a reunited Germany. And it's an enormous treasure trove of material about Marx's life and thoughts and ideas. This is the first biography to make use of this enormous publication, which is a great work of scholarship and of enormous interest to anyone interested in, enormous value to anyone interested in 19th century German history.
Were there any surprising finds in there for you?
There were no smoking guns that totally changed my opinion of Marx, but there are a number of interesting things, like the account of how Marx and Engels in the early phases of their friendship went through a phase in which they really couldn't stand each other, largely because Marx's wife immensely disdained Engels' mistress and led their two respective male significant others to fight with each other. That was just one more amusing example of things. There are some more serious matters, too, but yeah, there's just all sorts of little items that are very interesting.
We have Maureen. She asks in an email, Marx was so brilliant and well-intentioned. How does his ideas come to be used so perversely in the form of communism as it took form in the Soviet Union and China and Cuba?
There are lots of historical figures to whom that has happened. What I'd say about Marx in the 20th century is that Marx became, as I like to put it in my book, an icon. And he's that big dude with the big beard. And a lot of revolutionary movements in the 20th century, many different kinds, were attracted to that figure of the guy with the big beard. They didn't always pay close attention to his ideas. But the image of Marx, this intransigent revolutionary figure, made him sort of a patron saint of many, many different kinds of revolutionary movements, whether it was anti-imperialist movements in the Third World, the governments of the Eastern Bloc, the radical students of the 1960s in Europe, Western Europe and North America. Just all sorts of people were attracted, I think, less to the ideas of Marx than to the image of him as the intransigent revolutionary.
And, what do you think is the most misunderstood thing about Karl Marx today?
Whoa, that's a hard...
One of the most.
All right. Probably the most misunderstood thing about Marx is the idea that he was his economics, and we all think of Marx as the author of Das Kapital, was somehow dissident and different and unorthodox. And that was really not true in Marx's day. Marx was very much a close student of Adam Smith, and especially Smith's chief disciple, David Ricardo. He saw his work as perfecting theirs, as taking it to the logical consequence and applying Hegel's philosophical categories to their work to make it as good as it could be. He was not a dissident economist, and he actually didn't like socialist economists who said Smith and Ricardo were wrong. What happened is, towards the end of Marx's life, a whole new version of economics came along. We call this marginal utility theory. It's the basis of contemporary economics. And it was only there that Marx suddenly became dissident and unorthodox. He was never that way in his life.
Well, Jonathan Sperber, thank you. Jonathan Sperber is a history professor at MU and author of Karl Marx, A 19th Century Life. He'll be at the downtown Kansas City Public Library tonight at 6:30. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow for a look at the best chilled dishes in KC with our food critics. Up to Date is next, and they'll be taking your thoughts on the president's comments about racial profiling. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz. Our announcer is Kim Noble, and our program director is Bill Anderson. I'm Maria Carter, and this is KCUR.